All right, 1 Chronicles 18. Where we left off in 17 was the story of David recognizing the need for a permanent temple and how God responded to his idea. Now, I'm sure David was disappointed. 1 Chronicles 18. I'm sure David was disappointed in God's answer that he could not build him a temple, but he was encouraged and probably strengthened by the promise God gave him. And what was that promise? That his descendants, you got it? You have what?
You guys to go. We'll put you back down on you if you can't handle it.
That's okay.
She said that her family would be blessed.
Yeah, that would be the line that the Messiah would come in. He did not understand that quite yet, but his throne would be established forever. So, how do you think David felt about that? If you were told that your line, it's going to be there forever. What's that tell you? What would you do?
Make you feel untouchable.
Invincible would be the word I was looking for. Untouchable was it. Wouldn't that make you kind of feel invincible? My line is going to be here. God's going to protect my line. So that gives me a lot of freedom just to go out and do what needs to be done, because I already got a promise from God that even if I die, my family keeps the throne, so my throne's not going to be taken over by somebody else somewhere along the line. So he's probably a little bit on the invincible side right now, and he goes out to clean up after Saul and to destroy the enemies of Israel. This is not a real long study, but we'll go for a while. So I need somebody to read verses 1 and 2.
After this, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines, subdued them, and took Gath and its camps from the hand of the Philistines. Then he defeated Moab, and the Moabites became David's servants. Tribute.
Okay, so why the Philistines? Why go after the Philistines? Little history here, somebody?
They had the ark in the first place?
No. David had a little bit of a history of the Philistines. Anybody remember what was?
Goliath.
Very good. I'm glad somebody remembered David and Goliath. Goliath was a Philistine. So far, what had happened is the Philistines had been chased out of Israel's territory. But they were still a problem outside of the nation. They had never been conquered. They had only been fought with. So David goes out and he actually takes a certain city, the city of Gath. Why is that a notable city for them? Who was from Gath? Rachel?
Goliath.
Oh, very good. Goliath. How did you know? He actually took the city Goliath that his brothers called home. So that was a pretty big victory to start with, but it was also kind of a psychological victory, because he just reminded them that not only did he take out their big, tall hero, he just took his town away from them too. So pretty substantial. And then he goes after the Moabites. Anybody remember why the Moabites had to be dealt with? Yeah, and I don't remember either, but the
Lot and his daughter?
Yeah, you might be right. That sounds about right. I have to look it up. I didn't even look up to see who Moab was, because the reason he goes after Moab is not because of that relationship.
Oh.
It is found in Numbers chapter 25. Somebody read verses 1 through 5. Go ahead and read all 5 of them.
You said Numbers 25, what?
1 through 5.
Okay. Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people in the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord, out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, every one of you kill his men who were joined to Baal of Peor.
Okay, so God's a little bit mad about the Baal worship. He said, hang him and hang him in the sun. I mean, let's just make it as miserable as possible. That's pretty rough from a physical standpoint, but think about the spiritual warfare that just happened right there. What happened? What was the spiritual warfare battle in this situation?
Was it the start of Baal?
It was the start of Baal worship in Israel. A pretty big victory for somebody, wasn't it? Satan got a big hand up right there. Now, the person or the people that were affected by letting Satan have this victory were the Israelites themselves. God's will, we're going to talk about God's will a little bit. God's will still happened. God's will was, what was God's will for Israel? Well, they were to be his chosen people. That was the first thing. What was the second thing that was supposed to happen in their relationship with God?
Obedience.
Well, yeah, but these are a little tough to think of. God was supposed to be what to them?
Their king.
Their king. God was supposed to be their king. So they were chosen. God was going to be their king. And something was to be established through the nation of Israel, which was? Yep. That's how Jesus was going to come into the world. Those were the three plans, the three wills that God kind of had toward Israel. That is the difference between his sovereign will and his permissive will. In those instances, what was his sovereign will? The unchanged part of the will. God's sovereign will always happen. I'll give you an idea of the other type will we're going to talk about is his permissive will. So what was God's sovereign will? Out of those three things, what was his sovereign will?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ, the line of Jesus. Had to have the line of Jesus. Sovereign will, line of Jesus, had to happen. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. The other things were part of his permissive will. He wanted Israel to be set aside as a holy nation with him as the king, and he would have blessed him richly for that. And he also wanted to make sure that there was no other gods involved, no other idol worship involved. He didn't want that to go on. Well, they kicked him out as king eventually, but what they do with the Moabites, they started into idol worship, Baal worship. They started into Baal worship. Major problem. So God said, you know what? I want you to be my chosen person and I want you to live a holy life. And the people said, no. God's permissive will allowed them to say no. Then he said, I want to be your king. And they said, nope. And he said, okay. In my permissive will, you can say no to that. I want to establish the house of David so Jesus can come into the earth to redeem it. And God didn't care what the people said. He said, that's going to happen. That's his sovereign will. His sovereign will has to play out. Now, think about that in terms of your own life. How does that work out for you? How many times do we mess up God's permissive will for our life? Yeah, probably constantly. Can you imagine what that conversation is going to be like one day? When God sits down and he goes, hey, I've got to tell you. Remember when this happened? This is what I wanted you to do, and this is what you chose to do, and I let you choose wrongly. But if you had chosen correctly, if you had been obedient, this would have happened. There's a joke about that, about a guy who dies and he goes to heaven, and all these big fancy mansions, and he's curious what his looks like, and he kind of takes him down the street and said, this is yours. And it was a pretty big fancy mansion. It was in the shadow of a great big storage building. And he said, God, I really like the mansion. He said, but that building back there is blocking all the light. I'm in a big shadow. What's that building about? He said, that's all the blessings I couldn't give you because you weren't obedient. I had to put them somewhere. Think what that's going to be like if that would really happen to you. That's how it works. It affected the nation of Israel to the point where they were finally scattered. Go on. Because they chose wrongly. Kind of the same thing. All right, somebody read 3 and 4. And it probably should not be Kathy.
David smote Hadrer, king of Zobah, unto Hamath, and he went to establish his dominion by the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,000 chariots, and 7,000 horsemen, and 20,000 footmen. David also took all the chariot horses, but reserved them 100 chariots.
Now you see why I didn't want you to read it?
Yes, thank you.
What does that mean that he hamstrung the horses?
My horse has cut the leg muscles.
Yeah. If he cut the leg muscles, he cut the hamstrings, so the horses could not actually be used in battle or warfare or for much of anything. They were kind of helpless after that. And I'm guessing they probably had to be put down. If you cut a horse's hamstrings, would you have to put him down?
Probably not.
You don't think they can get still?
Only if it, now if he breaks his bones, yes.
Back then, probably.
Well, no, I mean, it's the hamstring. It's not the tendon. It's not an Achilles tendon or something like that where they couldn't move, but...
But a horse can survive, but you wouldn't be able to ride him.
It wouldn't be maneuverable. It would lose its ability.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if that meant they had to be put down if the horses were able to at least be still used for work animals or something. That's pretty drastic. And it's funny, how many of y'all are upset that that happened to all those horses? Nobody's upset they did that to all the horses?
Yeah.
How many of y'all was upset they hung a bunch of people in the sun? Funny how we just gloss over the hanging of the people, but we worry about the hamstringing of the horses. Isn't that strange how we look at that?
The people that were hung deserved it.
Yeah. Yeah,
the horses. The horses, they made bad choices. The horses didn't make
bad choices. I'm with you. It's just funny. It's how many people get snagged on that. One day you might talk to somebody and they're going to talk about this passage, about how cruel Christians were. They weren't Christians back then, but God followers, and doing this to horses.
Well, you saw what Budweiser does to their client standard.
Yeah. So, yes, all that.
I mean, it's still done to the animals today. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the same way I went to see Barnum and Bailey's Circus one time when it was in New York. I lived up there. And all the horses have that nice curve in their neck, you know, when they prance around. It's because they have a bridle and it's connected about a rope this long to the center of their chest. They can't raise their heads. That's why it's there. It's not that they walk around like that naturally. And there was a bunch of people protesting out front, and I picked up one of their brochures. And actually, I decided after that I'd probably never go to a circus again. They were pretty mean to the animals. And I'm not a big animal rights person, but it's pretty obvious. One of the questions in that brochure was, do you think elephants actually stand on one foot in the wild? No. There's never a reason for a wild animal to stand on one foot. And said, how do you think they get them to do it? And then it told the story of how they whip them into submission and make them stand on one foot. Funny, but we look at things on that so much worse sometimes because the animals we think are innocent. It wasn't their choice to actually do this. But in this situation, it wasn't to be mean to the animals. It was arms control. That's what that was. That was just a means of arms control. We needed to slow down their army. They needed to be brought down to size. And so he took away the power and effectiveness of his army. But I've seen comparisons where a mounted soldier is worth 20 foot soldiers. I don't know how they figured that out, and I'm not sure that's even the right number. I don't know if it's scientific or somebody took a guess. Couldn't figure out how they came up with it. So I'm not sure if it's a true comparison, but think of the advantage if your enemy is running around on foot and you're running around on horseback. First off, in fighting alone, you have a strategic advantage because you're taller. You're not going to tire out from running onto the battlefield. All you're doing is holding on. Horse is the one doing all the running. Everybody else is running towards you. But also, you can travel so much faster. That probably means instead of having to take 1,000 people with us, we can take 150 people with us. It means less supplies. Makes everything easier if the people are mounted. They can cover ground faster, more ground in a day. You know, it's a big advantage. So he said, you guys can't have that military advantage anymore. I'm just stopping that. You guys will be back to foot soldiers is what I'm going to give you. And we'll leave you enough for 100 chariots. That's all we're going to do. Let's go on with verses 5 and 6.
When the Syrians of Damascus came to Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute. So the Lord preserved David wherever he went.
Okay, so the Syrians are actually neighbors of King Hadadezer. And they decided to come to his rescue, which was a bad choice for them. They just came right out in the field and they got defeated too. A lot of commentators called this the undefeated season. And I finally found one guy, he compared it to a football team. What football team? Sean, you better be able to tell me what football team. What team had an undefeated season?
Patriots?
Yeah, your dad's favorite team. 72 and 73. The 72 season, they won all 14 regular season games. They won both playoff games, and they won the Super Bowl. They were completely undefeated. A team finally did it in 72. And everybody thought, well, now that that's happened, it'll probably happen again. It has never happened again. And now they're even saying it's probably will never happen again. Teams are too equally balanced out now. The draft has fixed so much stuff and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, David's kind of enjoying this undefeated season. Everywhere he goes, he wins. Everywhere he goes, he gets richer. Not personally, but the nation gets richer. Let's look at the big riches here. Number 7. Verse 7.
David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem.
You know, this is a strange situation. Gold is heavy. It's a very heavy metal. And it's a very soft metal. Not really what you would want to make any of your armaments for war out of. So why would you make shields out of gold? First off, can you imagine how heavy that was? Trying to carry a shield of gold. Probably had to have two guys per shield. I don't know. But why would you do that? It has something to do with the same reason you'd wear a chili cook-off ribbon at the church.
Right.
Oh! There we go. I'm just kidding, John. His personal success where he was from in his country probably had a lot to do with his idea that his personal bodyguard could carry gold shields because he was important and he had to look important and all that kind of stuff. That is part of what the problem is there. This king, I'm not sure where I put it. Let me see. I'm looking ahead here. No. This king was able to establish a little bit of power. He was a small country. They weren't really big. Hadadezer. They didn't really have a lot of territory. They weren't world powers. But he had been fairly successful in fighting with some of the neighboring countries around him. And the main reason he was successful, is because Assyria and the Babylonians were fighting each other. If they had not been fighting each other, they would have wiped him out a long time ago. But he was just taking advantage of this power vacuum they left in his area, and he stepped up into it. He thought he was big and powerful, and he was able to take on more. And he went out, and King David took him down. Then his neighboring king came over, and David took him down. And David winds up with a whole bunch of gold. Verse 8. Yeah, so brass and bronze have a lot in common. Some translations say bronze in this situation. They call the Brazen Sea the Bronze Sea, stuff like that. But anyway, this guy not only had the misfortune of losing his gold shields, he also lost a large amount of bronze. A large amount of bronze, which David promptly put into storage for use in the building of the temple. That we'll need that eventually. All right, so we're going to read 9 through 11 this time. We're going to jump up some.
Now, when Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated all the army of Hadadezer, king of Zobah, he sent Hadoram, his son, to King David to greet him and bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had been at war with Toi, and had Hadoram brought with him all kinds of articles of gold, silver, and bronze. King David also dedicated these to the Lord, along with the silver and gold that he had brought from all these nations, from Edom, from Moab, from the people of Ammon, from the Philistines, and from Amalek.
All right. So, this king, who had actually fought with Hadadezer before, decided that, "I don't like him anyway, I'm going to go make friends with David." He sends his son over as an ambassador, and he sends him with a whole bunch of wealth. Because he said, you know what? He's going to get the wealth one way or the other. Maybe I can keep part of it if I send him a bunch of it and try to become his friend. I don't want to fight him because he'll take it all. I'm just going to try to be nice and give him part. And it kind of worked out. What did this do for David, though? What's God doing for David and the nation of Israel right now?
Strengthening him.
He is strengthening him. Would you?
I say he's favoring him.
Well, on the world stage, what's happening?
Everyone's seeing who's empowered.
That's right. They're now starting to recognize Israel as a world leader, a world power. People have to learn to deal with Israel now. You just can't go over there and beat them up because you feel like it. They're actually winning. They are winning major victories, major battles. So God is establishing Israel as a world power. He is establishing the treasury of the temple. Everybody is contributing precious metals, some by losing, some by paying tribute. They're just all paying into this temple. And that all that's going to be used to build God's temple one day. It just shows, we go back to God's will. It was God's will that the temple be built a certain way. Israel didn't have all the gold and silver and bronze they needed, so God made sure people brought gold, bronze, and silver and set it in the temple. Worked out well. Came from the enemies. Or people who would have been enemies. We're going to change gears a little bit away from David's conquest. We're going to look at Abishai. Somebody read 12 and 13.
Moreover, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, killed 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He also put garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites became David's servants, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went.
So, first off, does anybody remember who Abishai's brother is? These guys go a little out on a limb a little bit later, but Joab. Joab's his brother. Joab, we'll find out in the next verse, is the general. He's the man in charge of the military. Where did the Edomites come from? Who did they descend from?
Esau.
Esau. The Edomites came from Esau. Turn to Genesis 25. Now think about this. Israel established dominion over the Edomites. And in order to ensure that dominion, Abishai built garrisons in Edom. So the Edomites had no choice but to become servants. They were a servant state now. They were not free and independent any longer. They were only alive because Israel allowed them to be alive. Genesis 25, verses 21 through 23.
Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea. Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger."
Who is the older?
Esau.
That's right. So that prophecy the Lord spoke back in Genesis was finally fulfilled right here. This is the fulfillment of it. This whole problem right here, let's go back to a little bit about Esau. What did Esau do that was so bad?
Tricked Jacob into giving him his birthright.
Not Esau.
Oh, was it the other way around?
Yeah. First off, let's start with, who was Isaac? What do we know Isaac as now in the Bible? What was his name changed to?
Isaac.
No.
Huh? Or not Jacob, Isaac. Isaac, let's go with Isaac. What was his name? No, yeah. What was Isaac's name?
Israel?
No, Jacob became Israel. Boy, now I'm lost on that. Now we've got thinking way too far on this. Isn't that? Yeah, Jacob, the father, became Israel. Jacob's name meant usurper because of his trick. Esau, though, sold something to his brother.
His birthright.
His birthright. He sold his birthright to his brother. Anybody remember what it was for?
A plate of food.
Yeah, soup. Bean soup, basically, is what it was. He wanted a bowl of porridge, a bowl of bean soup. He was hungry. It wasn't so much that he was so hungry he had to sell this. What did that tell you, though, about what he thought of his birthright?
It was worthless. The oil was selling him.
Well, not that it was worthless. What was the birthright? What did the birthright mean to Jewish people? The oldest person, the oldest son, had the birthright in the family. So what was it? What was part of it? Inheritance would be part. Whoever had the birthright would get the larger part of the inheritance. Sometimes he got half, no matter how many brothers they had, they divided the other half. That's how important. But the birthright was more than just material things. What was the other thing the material or the birthright involved that was not material?
Spiritual. Livestock?
That's material.
It says kind of spiritual advantage.
Not an advantage. They had a job. These guys existed prior to Aaron. They were to be the priest. The firstborn son had to become the priest for the family. He had to be trained in everything so he could offer the sacrifices and do everything, because there was no priestly line yet. Each family would had to have its own priest. It was always the firstborn son. Esau did not want to do that. Esau did not want anything to do with God. He wanted to just deal with the world. He wanted to go out, and he was a great hunter, and he just wanted to do whatever he wanted to do. He did not want the responsibility. So that becomes a problem. Jacob gets it from him. Jacob lived in a tent. And he was pretty quiet, pretty mild-mannered guy. But anyway, Esau turned his back on God. Let's go back to will. Let's go back to spiritual warfare. How do you think Satan felt when the firstborn said, I want to be a priest?
I'll be celebrated.
Yeah, he probably was. And what happened? The Edomites became a nation on their own because they were going to be a nation on their own, but they were never going to be getting along. Not the first time this happens, actually, it's not the last time this happens. This was probably the first time it happened, but it was not the last time it happened. So, but God protects David. Everything he touches is working out well. He's gaining victory. He's gaining wealth for the nation. He is not collecting wealth for himself, which he had every right to do as king. He could have made it the king's treasury, but instead he made it the temple treasury. Which, what do you think that was like? What do you think the temple treasury looked like by the time Saul got done?
Empty.
Yeah, it was probably all gone. It was probably in shambles. I mean, because he paid tribute. He did all kinds of stuff he shouldn't have been doing with Israel's money. So David comes in and actually restores the national treasury. So that brings national wealth. That's how even today money is valued. The gold that's in Fort Knox, that used to back our dollar. It made our dollar stronger than everything in the world. Now our dollar is backed by what? John, what's it backed by?
Make-believe.
You're right. It is. It's make-believe. It's what our dollar is worth what the government says it's worth. They can't back it. They can't back the dollar anymore. Not enough wealth to back the dollar. So that's why our dollar is worth less. That's why a lot of trades today on the international money market, they use Chinese money, and it's a Y-A-U-N. How do you pronounce that, Mike? Do you know? Yuan, Yan, Yuan, Yuans? Yuans are from Pennsylvania. I have any idea. But that's why, because we don't back our money anymore. David had a lot of wealth in the temple treasury, in the nation's treasury, made them very powerful, very, very powerful, because unfortunately, money does talk. And if you're going to be a military power, you'll have to have a strong economy to back it. God provided all that. Somebody read the rest of the chapter, 14 through 17.
So David reigned over all Israel and administered judgment and justice to all his people. Joab, the son of Zariah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Abimelech was the son of Abiathar, were the priests. Shavsha was the scribe. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Chariotites and the Peletites. And David's sons were chief ministers at the king's side. That was Mike's.
I just got to tell you, you come so far. You have come so far in those names. All right, Abimelech was named after his granddad, so you got to be careful not to confuse those two as you go through the Bible. They both had the same name. They worked in the same job. So, but the administration of David's kingdom is established and is divided among people he could trust. With the exception of one problem that they just mentioned here. What was it? If you notice, everybody has a job to do. But one group. What group doesn't have a defined position?
His sons.
They were chief ministers at the king's side. They were advisors to the king. They were...
No responsibility.
Yeah. They were just given a job with some power. How do you think that worked out for them? We know the story, in all honesty. Not so well. What happens when you put, first off, an unqualified person? They got their job because of who their dad was. And in all honesty, most of us probably would have not. Sean, if you became king, would Xander have an important, high-paying job? With no responsibility?
I might put it
to the basement. Oh, with no responsibility. Would you, if you were Joe Biden, would Hunter have the ability to make millions of dollars off your name? Probably so. People are going to do this. I mean, it shouldn't be done, and I'm not taking it up for Joe in any way, but this happens. The sons of important people, the children of important people, in this situation, the sons, have a tendency to have power that they don't officially have. So we are given people who are completely unqualified, other than the fact they're related to the man who doles out power, authority. And authority can be a problem to people who don't have any boundaries on their authority. How many of you all grew up with somebody whose dad would fix everything they ever got into? Because the dad had some power in the community. He would get in trouble, the dad would make a couple phone calls, the kid wouldn't be in trouble anymore. It happens. It happens. It's usually not a good thing to have happen. David's situation, it didn't work out so well either. So you have unqualified leaders with no limits on how they use their power. That's a problem, and I don't care how you slice it. It's a problem then, it'll always be a problem. It's a problem today, you know what I mean? Because authority is not about power. Anybody from the leadership class remember what authority is really about? It's not power. Starts with a
responsibility.
You have to be responsible. You have the authority to fix problems that you are responsible for. You're responsible to see something happens. So your authority is kind of limited. John, at your company, can you fire the president of the company? No. You could probably fire one of the guys who work for you, though, if you want to, couldn't you? Yeah. His authority is limited to what he is responsible for. He's not responsible for the president, so he can't fire the president. You're probably not responsible for the electricians either, are you? So you probably couldn't fire the electricians either. I mean, you could complain about them, but you probably couldn't fire them. You couldn't walk up and fire one. Not your responsibility. When you give somebody power with no bounds, they're going to run roughshod over people eventually. They're going to understand that. Put yourself in that time frame. If King David's son came up and said, "Mike, I want you to do this," are you going to say, "Well, that's not your job to tell me to do that"? You can't say that because you don't know what his job is. Right?
Right.
Maybe. Anybody remember the movie Apocalypse Now? Lasted forever and a day. I think it was as long as the Vietnam War. Anyway, there was a part where who's the star of that show? Martin Sheen. He's trying to track down this colonel who went rogue, and he jumps into a foxhole in the middle of the night, and he said, "Who's in charge here?" And one of the guys looked up and said, "Aren't you, sir?" I said, "No." But if you don't know what somebody's responsible for, and they have the rank, you're going to follow. It didn't take the kids long to figure out people were afraid of them. They had power. And unfortunately, power without restraint always breeds corruption. And these guys became corrupt.
It probably has a lot to do with the I factor. Like, they think that they're doing something. They're like, I, me, or whatever. Mm-hmm. When David understood that it was about God.
Right.
They think that they're doing something.
Yeah, that's a good point. David understood where the power actually came from. I'm not saying that he was anything different than we would have done for our own children. But there's something you can learn from that. Be careful giving your children power that they're not equipped to handle, that does not have a boundary. I don't know how many times you all have seen, I know I've seen it a couple of times, where a man works hard and he builds a business and it becomes a very profitable business, and by the time the grandson's in charge, it goes under. It goes from being the top of the chain to not being able to pay their taxes. It'll happen. Because you get the power without the responsibility is what happens. You don't know how you got there. So David kind of messed up on that one, but that goes back to God's permissive will. Probably not his choice for those guys to have that type. Having a position, no problem. Having a position they're qualified for would have been the catch, though. They had to be something they were qualified for. They just couldn't ride around and say, I'm the king's son, you have to do what I say.
No, it wasn't. It couldn't have been all of his sons, right? Because one of them had to build the temple.
Well, Solomon wasn't here yet. Solomon had not been born yet. So if you go back into the story of David, you remember Absalom, rebellion, one of the sons. You also have one of the sons raping one of the daughters, and a whole bunch of stuff happens with that first set of kids that happens. Solomon was in the second set of kids from Bathsheba, not from the first set of kids that came from everybody else. Because there wasn't just one mom involved in that. There were concubines and multiple wives and all kinds of stuff going on. Again, out of God's plan. God's plan was kings don't marry more than one person. Their plan was we're going to marry every person we see. So, and if you're already married, no big deal. We'll just have your husband killed in battle and we'll marry you. That's how they worked back then. So, again, God's permissive will allowed them to behave the way they behaved outside of what God wanted for them. It makes me wonder, and it should make you wonder, what would Israel have looked like if they had ever obeyed God for any length of time at all? You know, they'd get it for a short while with one king, but the next king would come in and it would go right back down. And you might have two or three bad kings in a row before you got another good one, and he would serve. Even if he served 40 years, he didn't serve long enough to really change the nation, because as soon as he was gone, everybody went right back to what they were. But what do you think would have happened? I mean, I wonder what would happen if Israel had honored God their whole time. So, again, put that thought back into your own life. What would happen if you had been honoring God your whole life?
It would be a different world.
It would be.
Completely.
It wouldn't be different. I would give it that. I don't know how it would be different, but I am sure it would be different. We don't know the blessings we miss because we don't do what God expects us to do. I hope we never know. I hope we never know. So, any questions?